Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. commander of Operation Inherent Resolve, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, said Wednesday the operation to retake the Syrian city Raqqa from Islamic State poses tough political and security challenges and could take longer than the ongoing assault on Mosul in Iraq.
It's a very complicated battle space. There are a lot of regional security concerns that are in competition there. The Syrian regime's involved. The Russians are involved. Turkey's involved. It's hard. And there's a, there's a civil war going on right next door. So it's going to be a tough, very tough political environment and a security environment, I think, for our effort there.
He said Kurdish rebels known as the YPG and elements of the Syrian Democratic Forces could eventually be a major part of the Raqqa operation. He said talks with Turkey are underway. Turkey, which has its own security presence in Syria, opposes any involvement of Kurdish fighters. Meanwhile, at the UN Wednesday, the world body's humanitarian chief, Stephen O'Brien, said the eastern part of the Syrian city Aleppo has essentially become a kill zone, with hundreds killed, thousands wounded in just the past month.
The Aleppo offensive by Syrian and Russian military forces has been the most sustained and intensive aerial bombardment campaign witnessed since the beginning of the conflict more than half a decade ago. The results in human terms have been horrific. Aleppo has essentially become a kill zone.
The Russian ambassador expressed outrage at the remarks, pointing to Moscow's humanitarian pause of last week and its 10-day halt of aerial attacks in the center of Aleppo. In Somalia, local residents say Islamic State fighters seized the small port of Kandala in the semi-autonomous region of Puntland. The IS news agency said dozens of fighters seized the port located in the Gulf of Aden. This is VOA News. In Iraq, a U.S. coalition spokesman says as Iraqi and Kurdish Peshmerga forces edge closer to Mosul, the Islamic State defense is stiffening. 10 days into the assault to retake the last major Iraqi city held by IS militants, Iraqi forces are trying to dislodge militants from surrounding villages. There are reports IS defenders, as they retreat, use civilians as human shields. Meanwhile, thousands of liberated villagers have been relocated to camps for their safety. The two main U.S. presidential candidates pressed their case to the voters in states viewed as key to election victory November 8. Democrat Hillary Clinton marked her 69th birthday Wednesday in Florida. Her Republican rival Donald Trump ended a three-day campaign swing through the Sunshine State and moved on to North Carolina, where he reached out again to African-American voters, a traditional Democratic voting bloc, during a stop in the city of Charlotte.
Every African-American citizen in this country is entitled to a government that puts their jobs, wages, and security first.
Campaigning in Tampa, Florida, Clinton promised to grow the economy with more jobs and rising incomes. Two strong aftershocks shook central Italy late Wednesday, not far from the area struck by a deadly August quake. A 5.4 magnitude quake was followed hours later by a stronger 6 trembler, which was centered near the town of Castellangelo sur Nera. Some damage reported, at least 2 injured. The August 24th quake killed nearly 300. In Venezuela, beset by a severe economic crisis, including food shortages, opposition protesters took to the streets, clashing with police Wednesday. The opposition staged nationwide marches, drawing hundreds of thousands against embattled President Nicolas Maduro, who told his own countermarchers the opposition is desperate, trying to destroy the Venezuelan revolution. An electoral council halted a nationwide referendum recall by the opposition to remove Mr. Maduro from office and end 17 years of socialist rule. For the first time in a quarter century, the U.S. abstained Wednesday from a U.N. General Assembly vote on a resolution calling for an end to the U.S. economic embargo of Cuba. Samantha Powers, the U.S. U.N. ambassador.
The United States has always voted against this resolution. Today, the United States will abstain.
The 193-member General Assembly adopted the resolution, 191 in favor. Israel joined the U.S. in abstaining. The U.S. and Cuba announced a normalizing of ties 2 years ago. The embargo in place against the communist regime for more than half a century can only be ended by Congress. The younger brother of the late Japanese Emperor Hirohito has died, Prince Mikasa, passing away Thursday at age 100. He was the uncle of the current Emperor Akihito. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barté in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi defends its decision to leave the International Criminal Court as it presents its letters of intent to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
We cannot hide racism under the cover of international justice. We cannot hide neocolonialism under the cover of international justice. We're talking about justice, and justice has to be fair.
Ali Nyamitwe, Burundi's foreign minister, Ethiopia rules out early elections as the opposition says a proposed government reorganization would fall short of needed changes. UNICEF says more than 100 child soldiers were freed Wednesday in South Sudan, and Swaziland nurses have threatened to strike next week for better working conditions.
Nurses of the Kingdom of Swaziland have resolved that there should be a need of improving the conditions of service for their work in the country.
CBC's Lou Shaba is the national secretary of the Swaziland Nurses Association, and the Zika virus remains a threat as it continues to spread globally. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Burundian government has vehemently defended its decision to leave the International Criminal Court, the ICC. This comes as two other African countries, Gambia and South Africa, have joined the gradually growing list of African countries that are leaving the court. Burundian Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says his government's decision to leave the ICC is in line with regulations in the Rome Statute, the treaty that established the ICC. He denied Burundi is leaving the ICC because the court was looking into allegations of human rights violations, disappearances, and killings carried out by unidentified groups allegedly associated with the government's youth militia and armed opposition. Nyamitwe says his government does not believe the ICC is focused on Africa because it wants to protect victims of alleged crimes. Rather, Nyamitwe says the ICC is focused on Africa for politically motivated reasons.
People of Burundi have demonstrated, asking their own leaders to expedite the process of withdrawing from the ICC. The two chambers of parliament have met and have voted for Burundi to withdraw from the ICC. The president of the republic has promulgated law, that text which was, that bill which was voted in parliament. I guess you have all indications that there is no going back. So for us, that is a done deal.
Have you written to the Secretary General to make known your intention? Because that is when the process becomes official.
James, let us give ourselves a few more hours. I can tell you that that has been done. If the Secretary General has not yet made it public, then he should do so soon. All I know is that the dispatch has taken place. Now, I cannot give you details on at what time exactly the SU to receive the document, but that has been done. I can confirm.
I wanted you to articulate your government's reasons for wanting to pull out of the ICC because yesterday I spoke with a human rights lawyer who indicated that your government was withdrawing from the ICC because you were being investigated because of allegations of crimes against humanity in your country, and you don't want the ICC to come and implicate some members of your government.
And why would Gambia and Zimbabwe withdraw? No, come on. I believe that, first of all, it is a right of all sovereign states which had become parties to the Rome Statute at a certain point to withdraw at the time of their choosing. And that is exactly what Burundi has done under Article 127 of the Rome Statute. Secondly, I really believe that it is too much of fabrication to say that the government of Burundi has withdrawn from the ICC because it was accused of crimes against humanity. I challenge you and I challenge that lawyer to find any legal document from the prosecutor that has accused government Burundi on the grounds of crimes against humanity. I think one has to be clear. ICC has not indicted anybody in Burundi on crimes against humanity, of genocide, or any other crime that falls within its jurisdiction. But suffice it to say that the government of Burundi has considered that the Rome Statute which established the ICC was no longer relevant to Burundi. It is up to other state parties, whether they are in Africa, whether they are not in Africa, to determine whether that instrument is still relevant to them. If it is, then fine, they can stay with the ICC. If it is no longer relevant, then they should also quit. And for those who have not yet ratified, if they feel that it is relevant, then I invite them to ratify, including the U.S. and others.
The concern here is that without the ICC, there will be no protection for victims of crimes.
James, I do not want to dwell on this debate. I can tell you clearly that I do not believe that the move of the ICC in Africa is purely motivated by the crimes that are supposedly committed by some people in African countries. I believe that there are some other politically motivated reasons which have pushed ICC to act on African cases. Definitely, on that one, nobody will convince me otherwise because it's obvious. Tell me, James, how many times have you heard about the ICC investigating crimes committed in Iraq? How many times have you heard the ICC investigating crimes committed in Afghanistan? Or not even go further. Which groups have been under investigation on crimes in Libya? Let's be serious. We ought to start being serious. When talking about international justice, we have to be serious. Please, we cannot hide racism under the cover of international justice. We cannot hide neocolonialism under the cover of international justice. We're talking about justice, and justice has to be fair. The moment it doesn't look like it is fair, then justice has completely died.
Ali Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the Angolan capital, Luanda. Nurses in Swaziland are threatening to go on strike next week after the government failed to meet their demands for better working conditions. Last week, leaders of the Swaziland Nurses Association presented a petition to Prime Minister Barnabas Sibusiso Dlamini demanding better working conditions. They also issued an ultimatum to go on strike within 7 days if the administration failed to address their concerns. The ultimatum expired Wednesday, and the government has yet to signal its intentions, according to Sibusiso Lushaba, National Secretary of the Swaziland Nurses Association. Lushaba tells VOA's Peter Clotty there was a consensus at the meeting to lobby or pressure the government not only to improve working conditions, but also create more opportunities for nurses across the country.
Nurses of the Kingdom of Swaziland have resolved that there should be a need of improving the conditions of service for their work in the country. As a nursing profession, we are faced with a gross shortage of nurses in the country due to some plethora of reasons. Key among them is that government is not creating enough posts for nurses. You know, nursing is not being prioritized in the country by the government. That is our view, whereby we have a nurse population pressure of 1:1,000, and it is decreasing by the day because the government is not necessarily creating new posts for nurses, so that is going to go hand in hand with the demand for nursing services, which can result into improved health outcomes for patients. So that is one of the major challenges that we're facing.
When you met the officials at the Prime Minister's office to present your petition, what was the response and how long did they say they are going to take to address your concerns?
Well, actually, the petition was received by the principal secretary in the office of the prime minister because the prime minister was not around. The response was that they are going to respond within the stipulated period because we gave them 7 working days to respond to the issues that were raised that pertains to our conditions of services, that shortage of nurses and also issues of training. So we're expecting them to respond to those particular issues. But up until today, which is it is the 7th working day. We have not yet been called to discuss the issues that we are raising, which we believe are genuine, and we have not been called to discuss them. So we see that there is no political will to resolve these particular problems. And it will be an unfortunate situation whereby we'll find ourselves with nothing else to do but to do what all workers of the world does when an employer is not listening, you know, going on strike. But that is a process which we are going to embark on next week. The process of ensuring that those particular logistics are made to ensure that becomes successful. But at this point, and with the view that government is not necessarily coming to the party, it might happen that next week it might go on strike.
You issued an ultimatum. The ultimatum ends Wednesday. Thursday, Friday, you are not doing anything. Is that a grace period for the government to act? before deciding to embark on the threat of going on strike next week, beginning Monday?
Yes, we will give government that grace period. But at the same time, we will also be fastening some loose ends on our side to ensure that when things start, they kick start, and we know that it's all systems go. So basically, we are saying let us engage on these issues. And if government is not willing to engage us on these issues, we will have no alternative. Because I think that is important. We are dealing with lives here, and we are not dealing with machines, but we are dealing with human lives.
The government has often said that it doesn't have the money to pay for the sharp increase that nurses want. This they have told to a lot of public sector workers. Why do you think yours is different?
Swaziland is one of the countries that is leading in terms of HIV infection rate in the world. And that disease burden rests upon nurses in the country, because you'll appreciate the fact that Swaziland does not have a medical school. So it does not produce doctors. So we have most nursing schools that are producing nurses. And our nurses are highly trained in the country. They can compete anywhere. So most of the work, the burden that is being carried of healthcare delivery system in the country, it is done by nurses. It is not an issue of rhetoric that we normally hear about health systems being on the shoulder of nurses. So now, if you continue to improve, to introduce new programs that are aimed at assisting the population, making sure that you have a healthy population, it is also prudent that you also increase the number of staff, you know, the number of nurses. So now, if you want to keep issues of HIV and you want to have a healthy population in Swaziland, it is imperative that you also increase the number of posts for nurses. You can't have, as I've said, 1.2 million people being cared for 1,200 nurses. It cannot happen anywhere, even in the region, in the Sadc region. If you look at the number of nurses versus the population in the region, you'll find that Southern has got the lowest. So we are saying that must the country can be able to do that, because if you can add 500 nurses more to what we have today, it can a little bit alleviate the burden. That cannot be enough, but it can alleviate the burden. And that is what the government can be able to do.
Sibusiso Lushaba is the National Secretary of the Swaziland Nurses Association. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotte from the capital, Mbabane. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 27th. Daybreak Africa time, 18 minutes past the hour. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says more than 100 child soldiers were freed on Wednesday by armed groups in South Sudan. But as armed opposition groups continue to wage war against the South Sudan government, UNICEF says it fears the recruitment of children could rise, even as aid groups work to rescue more children. Ayen Bio has more from Washington.
The United Nations Children's Emergency Relief Agency says it's the largest number of freed children since last year. UNICEF says 145 child soldiers were released today in Boma State's Pabor town. They will be placed in an interim care center until their families can be found. Today's release represents a small fraction of the more than 16,000 children who have been recruited to fight in South Sudan's ongoing conflicts. But Vedasto Nzanzugwanko, UNICEF's chief of child protection in South Sudan, says it offers a glimmer of hope.
These 145 children, they are children who remained in Cobra faction when 1,755 children were released last year. So we continue discussing with Cobra faction, which is this opposition group, to make sure that all children who are still in their ranks are released.
Over 1,700 children were released in the Greater Pabor administrative area last year, a major step toward freeing the thousands of children who have been fighting in South Sudan's conflict. Nzanzugwanko admits the goal of freeing all child soldiers is a difficult task. More than 800 children are estimated to have been recruited this year alone. He says, unfortunately, the demand for fighters continues to grow.
After the war started in 2013, we have seen massive recruitment. And in our report, monitoring and reporting mechanism, it has shown that since 2013, over 16,000 children have been recruited in South Sudan, which is very unfortunate. So I would agree that there's a lot of recruitment, different faction and groups, they are beefing up their human resources. And while we are continuing advocating for their release, we see that the communities are reporting children being recruited.
Nzanzu Gwanko says the freed children, who are 14 to 17 years old, are able to interact with aid workers and officials who are working to reintegrate them into society. But he says working for an armed group at an early age has taken a physical and mental toll on them. He says the children will receive counseling and psychosocial support in the coming months.
If you look at the children, for sure, they seem to be affected psychologically. And during reintegration program, one and first action from social workers will be to assess and profile them and look at how they have been affected and provide them with psychosocial support. Then they'll be able to join education, to join school. Those who are eligible to go back to school, and others will be going to vocational training and other livelihood programs.
UNICEF says they continue to receive reports of child recruitment in Unity, Jonglei, and other states by both government and opposition forces, despite their ongoing work with the government's National Disarmament, Demobilization, and Reintegration Commission, and despite a signed commitment by both the South Sudan Army and the SPLM in opposition not to recruit children into their ranks. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Ethiopia's government has ruled out holding new nationwide elections to address the grievances behind nearly a year of deadly protests. But the opposition says the changes the government is undertaking are not good enough. Martha van der Wolf has more from Addis Ababa.
Government spokesman Gedachew Reda says Ethiopia will not call for an early vote. The next regional and nationwide elections are scheduled for 2020.
So what we are trying to do is to follow the election cycle. This government doesn't have the slightest of intention to all of a sudden change the law and call for a vote based on a changed law. We are here for the long haul.
Reda said Wednesday, Parliament will instead convene to endorse a proposal from the Prime Minister to reorganize the cabinet. That is expected in the next week, though Reda did not give an exact date. Opposition leader Merera Gudina of the Oromo People's Congress told VOA this crisis can only be solved with new elections.
Still playing their own game, that is reshuffling of their own personnel. Which for us it is nothing. When people are asking fundamental basic change of policies and resignation of the ruling party and therefore asking and demanding for new elections.
During protests in the past year, hundreds have died, thousands have been arrested, and the government has imposed a 6-month state of emergency restricting movement and independent media. Students began demonstrating in the central Oromia region in November of last year over an urban expansion plan for the capital city. But the movement has widened to take on a host of concerns. Since 1991, the country has been run by the same political coalition led by the Tigrayan ethnic minority. Earlier this week, the Oromia regional government appointed new leadership. But those appointments were from within the same party. The regional government remains led by an ethnic Oromo faction within the ruling coalition, the Oromo People's Democratic Organization, OPDO.
ጥያቄዎቹን የለማት ጥያቄዎቹን በአጠቃላይ ያሉትን ጥያቄዎችን በአግባቡና በወቅቱ ፈጥነን አልመለስንም ነው.
Fikaru Tesma, spokesman for the Oromia Regional Government, says they agree they have not responded to the development needs of the Oromo people in the appropriate manner and speed. But he says that they did not come to the conclusion that the OPDO cannot lead and administer the Oromo people. Human rights organizations have often criticized Ethiopia for its lack of human rights and political freedom. In the last elections in 2015, the ruling party won all the parliament seats. The government has suggested adjusting the electoral law so opposition parties could take more seats. Solomon Tesema of the Blue Party says changes to one law are not enough at a time when people are demanding freedom.
We need to have even other compromises, both within the party and outside the party. We are now working to end up the EPRDF's monopoly. In every policy and in every activity that is going on for the last 25 years.
The international community has called for an inclusive dialogue to address grievances and has called for security forces to show restraint. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The World Health Organization warns that Zika, the virus linked to abnormalities in newborn babies and neurological disorders, remains a major threat as the mosquito-borne disease continues to spread globally. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization declared the Zika virus a public health emergency of international concern on February 1st, and it remains so until now. Since the mosquito-borne disease was detected in Brazil in 2015, WHO reports the Zika virus has spread to 67 other countries for a total of 73 infected areas since 2007. Of these, it says 23 countries or territories have reported cases of microcephaly, a birth defect that causes babies to be born with abnormally small heads. Most of these cases, more than 2,000, are found in Brazil. WHO says a lot of Zika activity is happening in Southeast Asia right now, in Thailand, Singapore, and Vietnam. In Africa, it reports 5 suspected cases of microcephaly are being investigated in Guinea-Bissau. In addition, WHO says 19 countries and territories have reported an increased incidence of Guillain-Barré syndrome, an autoimmune disorder. WHO acting Zika virus incident manager Boris Pavlin says in most situations, Zika is a mild illness, but it can be quite a severe disease and a few people have died of it. He tells VOA that WHO's main focus is on prevention of microcephaly and other birth complications.
That is absolutely the reason that we are so concerned about this. We've rarely seen a virus that spreads so far, so fast, and has the potential to cause, yes, rarely, but on such a large scale that it becomes a massive burden.
In his first quarterly progress report, WHO says advances are being made in evaluating different tools for more accurately and quickly diagnosing Zika. It says work is moving ahead in the development of vaccines against Zika, noting that 2 vaccines currently are holding Phase 1 clinical trials. WHO says it will need $112.5 million through next year to carry out its many Zika-related activities. These include research and development, prevention of Zika virus infections, and care and support of vulnerable communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Gambia accused the International Criminal Court of ignoring war crimes as it withdrew from the institution on Tuesday, following in the footsteps of South Africa and Burundi, which withdrew from the court earlier this month. Gambia's Information Minister, Sherif Bojang, accused the court system of being racist and unfairly targeting Africans for prosecution. All but one of 10 investigations launched so far by the ICC have taken place in African countries. And that is it for this Thursday, October 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Zubair El Tayeb, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good Thursday.
On November 8th, American citizens will exercise their right to vote and choose their next president. VOA is providing comprehensive coverage of this unique democratic process. Who is going to earn the trust of the American people to lead the nation for the next 4 years? Find out right here on VOA.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.